This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Nick, and this is Circus Maximus on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. We've got people in the chat room, so join us and join the chatters. It's Friday night, and it is April 15th, 2016. The show, I'm going to be writing solo, and the topic is going to be a multi-part series that I'm going to title The New Right and its K Street Financiers. And to begin, I'm going to start off from where I know my research, where a lot of that began with the New Right, and that was the formation of the Council for National Policy, where that was a think tank on K Street that was formed on behalf of the Reagan Revolution that was there intended to back him, amongst other different activities that have taken place. And the reason why I wanted to get on to this topic is not to beat up the CNP to death, because other people have done a lot of research, including myself, on this topic. But originally, why I got into this again, why I'm going to be covering this, is because of the rise of Donald Trump and his PR firms, his political aides, his campaign managers, and whatnot. And I really wasn't aware of who this Roger Stone character was until not too long ago, with all the different alternative media radio sites that he's been playing, jumping on and visiting and doing interviews with quite a bit. And for somebody who's a major player for the GOP, being on alternative media as much as he has been, especially the Alex Jones show, where if you want to know anything about PSYOPs and controlled opposition, all you have to do is listen to the Alex Jones show. Look at his guest list. I will do a short rundown of his guests that he has had on. Alex Jones has had Ron Paul on. Ron Paul, promoted heavily by Alex Jones, father, Freemason, wife, Carol, Freemasonic Order of the Eastern Star, and his daughters, members of the Rainbow Girls, which is also a Freemasonic organization. Peter Thiel, Bilderberg attendee, funded Paul to the tune of $2.7 million, co-wrote The Case for Gold with Lewis Lehrman, who was CFR, Council for National Policy, Knights of Malta, Project for a New American Century, worked and financed Arbusto Oil, which was Bush's company. And Lehrman also founded Citizens for America, which worked with Oliver North and the Contras to murder untold numbers of people in the Central American region. Also funded anti-communist forces in Angola and Afghanistan. Denies 9/11 truth, affiliated with the John Birch Society, promoter of Rockefeller and Koch financed Austrian economics libertarianism, Grover Norquist, CFR, CNP, also worked on Iran-Contra, whose wife works for USAID, who I've covered before, CIA operation to fund revolutions overseas. And Norquist also worked with Ron Paul and spoke at many of his events and voted for the war in Afghanistan, founded the Tea Party with Koch money. And Rand Paul, also a member of the Council for National Policy, quoted as saying, any attack on Israel will be treated as an attack on the United States. So I'm going to stop right there. This Roger Stone character has got a long history of working with other revolutionaries overseas with his PR firm buddies, Terry Dolan, Charlie Black, Paul Manafort, Lee Atwater, Peter Kelly. Their company at one point was BMS and K. And Terry Dolan also was CNP. He died of AIDS. And this term, the new right, it's being used in the pro-white movement. Greg Johnson uses that term quite a bit. He prefers it over the alt-right. And we've covered the alt-right quite a bit. And the new term that he likes is the new right, this Greg Johnson over Countercurrents. And I thought of him when I heard of Terry Dolan dying of AIDS. So, but yeah, I've recently confronted Greg Johnson on Twitter. No response as far as his concept of the new right, which is the term that the Council for National Policy and a lot of the Reaganites have been using ever since, the evangelical right. And we're going to read an article real quick, remembering the new right. This was written in 2009, Political Strategy and the Building of the GOP Coalition by Richard Mager. And I'm going to start reading. When the Washington Post ran on an obituary for Paul Weyrich, who happens to be one of the main founders of the Council for National Policy, on its front page last December, this would have been in 2008, the casual reader could be forgiven for not recognizing the name, but those who followed conservative politics inside Washington probably approved of the significant placement. Weyrich was the creator or co-creator of a dozen prominent conservative institutions over the past 35 years and hosted weekly meetings over that span where conservative activists and government officials shared ideas and strategies with each other. While no single person is responsible for the striking success of conservative policies and politics since the 1970s, Weyrich probably comes closest to deserving the credit. Weyrich was at the center of what in the Reagan era was called the New Right. This moniker typically contrasted with the Old Right, or Robert Taft and Barry Goldwater, is often misunderstood. I'm going to want to do a show solely just on Barry Goldwater. I think that's an important aspect to this because the people I mentioned, your Terry Dolan, Paul Manafort, Lee Atwater, Charlie Black, Roger Stone, were all connected in that fashion with the Barry Goldwater campaign, where they did obtain the different donors to the Goldwater campaign and kind of ran with that to create a base from the Barry Goldwater campaign. And we're going to get into later on the history of Roger Stone, Charlie Black, Paul Manafort, Lee Atwater, Terry Dolan, Peter Kelly, the BMS and K PR firm lobby group, And that's probably going to have to be broken up into multiple shows. So bear with me. It's a lot of information. It's a huge web. It's not going to be possible to cram it all in a 2-hour, 3-hour show. It would be a lot better to break it down and not be information overload. So, many journalists and scholars have misused the term to refer to conservatism in general or include as part of its conservative leaders who are wholly unrelated, but the new right refers to a force that is both smaller and of greater scope than conservatism as a whole. Eagle Forum founder Phyllis Schlafly, CNP member, herself often placed under the new right umbrella, called the phrase a term of art for the Weyrich group, demarcating a handful of conservative operatives. Pardon me with reading. I've been burning my eyes out being in front of a computer screen researching this information for like 3-4 days in a row. I could use some eye drops. But it also indicates something greater than just a group of individuals. The new right not only helped bring conservatives to national power in the late 1970s, but changed the nature of the Republican Party and partisan politics in Washington for decades to follow. Republican politics today, at least at the domestic level, centers on alliance between free market economics and Christian cultural conservatism. It was the new right that opened the door to the social issue activists and Christian evangelicals who now make up the Republican voter base. Just as significantly, these operatives harnessed the energy of the new wave of conservatism during the 1970s to propel the GOP back into national governing power. Without Reagan, of course, there was no Reagan Revolution. But it is hard to see how the revolution happened without Weyrich and his colleagues either. Today, in the apparent age of Obama, conservative forces may seem headed back to the 1950s, a time when free market, small government standard bearers were marginalized except when hunting communists, the McCarthyan era. Even GOP victories during that period were led by establishment moderates like Eisenhower, who basically accepted New Deal economic reforms such as Social Security, corporate regulation, and a stronger federal role in governance. But the Republicans now seem determined to stick with the new right playbook, no matter the cost. With Weyrich gone and the rest of his colleagues also dead or marginalized, it is a good time to look back and see exactly what the new right accomplished and what their legacy might mean for today's Republican politics. Okay. What was the new right? The new right refers both to a movement and a group of like-minded conservative activists who came together in the 1970s and built an effective political force for the Republican Party out of existing networks. There were five key strategists: Weyrich, the institution builder; Richard Viguerie, the direct mail fundraising guru; Morton Blackwell, a Republican insider who worked for Viguerie; grassroots organizer Howard Phillips; and Terry Dolan, who headed the group's political action committee. Almost all had cut their political teeth during Barry Goldwater's presidential run of the previous decade. As Blackwell later recounted, all of us had something to do with the Goldwater campaign. We weren't high enough in the campaign to know each other, but our involvement with Goldwater credentialed us for each other. Blackwell had been a 1964 GOP delegate from his native Louisiana. In fact, the youngest delegate at the San Francisco convention, and later became executive director of the College Republicans. Youth organizations, in fact, where many new right figures learned the art of politics. Viguerie had gotten his start fundraising for the Young Americans for Freedom, YAF for short, a conservative youth group shepherded by William F. Buckley Jr. We know who Buckley is, I'm sure, our listeners.
Vigory later started raising money for conservative candidates for Congress. In 1972, the key moment for the New Right happened when fellow YAF member Lee Edwards, later unofficial historian of the conservative movement, introduced Vigory to Blackwell. Vigory had already developed a reputation as a prodigious fundraiser, building a bedrock conservative mailing list from the federal election records of Goldwater donors. As Blackwell noted later, it was rumored that he had behind his desk a large faucet that he could turn on and money would come out for whatever campaign he worked for. But by the early 1970s, Vigory's agenda had broadened. He told Blackwell, "Morton, I want you to come help me build the conservative movement." Blackwell introduced Vigory to Terry Dolan, who was then active in the Young Republicans, and Paul Wyrick. While he had served as a staffer for prominent Senate Republicans, Wyrick also made a second career out of developing conservative counters to liberal institutions. For example, he helped launch the Heritage Foundation think tank in the early 1970s to provide a conservative counterpoint to the then liberal Brookings Institute and the Conservative Republican Study Committee in Congress to offset a similar liberal caucusing organization on the Democratic side. The group began to meet regularly and develop ways of promoting conservative ideas and causes. Perhaps the chief distinction between them and previous old right constellations was that what scholar Gillian Peel called a new mood that included a determination to succeed. Their predecessors seemed more concerned about being right than winning political battles, said Blackwell. Conservatives seemed to think that we just needed to logically prove that we were right, to logically prove that our people were better than them. But that's not the real nature of politics. Winners are determined by the number and effectiveness of the activists over time, he said. In this regard, Blackwell and his colleagues were clearly influenced by the successes of the different liberal social movements and causes of the 60s. As Vigory later noted, all the New Right has done is copy the success of the old left. So the New Right began to teach themselves how to market your ideas, as Vigory wrote in 1978 newsletter, "Successful politicians do not bore the voters." And we're actually seeing a circus show right now with the Trump campaign. And I think that's also something that Roger Stone has said. Trump will not bore you. So kind of goes back to the motto that Vigory wrote. The New Right began to make themselves known during the early to mid-1970s. Wyrick began hosting official coalition meetings in 1973. And Vigory held his own strategy sessions as well. Vigory and Blackwell also restarted the National Conservative Political Action Conference that lay dormant after the Goldwater defeat, creating a more formal venue for conservatives to strategize and make political connections. The group's efforts at building a national coalition brought them into contact with former Nixon administration official Howard Phillips, who happens to be a Mormon, by the way, whose conservative caucus acted as a grassroots conduit from Washington to conservatives across the nation. By 1977, a Newsweek article grouped the New Right crew in with Anita Bryan and Phyllis Schlafly as forces that were stirring up grassroots conservative action. In the article, Wyrick noted that conservatives have been led by an intellectual movement, but not a practical movement up till now. And you see the intellectual movement of the National Policy Institute, too, don't you? To finish, he and other conservatives, he argued, were moving aggressively to correct that deficit. Schlafly's talent, in part, was her ability to translate conservative ideas to grassroots activities and motivate them to achieve political goals. She mobilized women from outside of the Republican Party structure while brokering a peace with the stalwart conservative women's loyalists she knew from her days as vice president of the National Federation of Republican Women. To supplement their networking and grassroots organizing, the New Right also issued a number of publications for both grassroots conservatives and Washington elites, including Viguerie's New Right Report newsletter and Conservative Digest magazine, as well as Phillips voting guides and newsletters. More importantly, the New Right began to seek out alliances with sympathetic Republicans. Some observers felt that the New Right intended from the beginning to form a conservative political organization outside of the two-party system. Such an urge would have been understandable. Phillips, for example, had earned his conservative bona fide by resigning his post as head of Nixon's Office of Economic Opportunity when the president failed to veto Democratic social programs. In the 1990s, Phillips finally abandoned the GOP when he founded the U.S. Taxpayers, now Constitution Party, which Aaron Russo was ahead of at one point, too. Still, the New Right had too many ties to the Republican Party to forsake their best chance to overturn liberal New Deal programs. Weyrich and Blackwell were longtime Republican operatives, and the New Right used their connections to help GOP conservatives. For instance, Viguerie had assisted Jesse Helms, another CMP over in North Carolina, in building the National Congressional Club, which distributed money to GOP candidates. Towards the end of the 1970s, Representative Phil Crane hosted weekly meetings of conservative activists, including New Right figures, and Nevada Senator Paul Laxalt sponsored New Right-approved pro-family legislation in the House. The New Right's ties to the GOP became manifest in 1978 when they threw all of their resources into defeating entrenched liberal Democrats in the midterm congressional elections. Dolan's National Conservative NCPAC, we'll say, money was fed by Viguerie's direct mail operation. Remember, guys, this is before the internet. These funds, combined with Viguerie's and Phillips' ability to communicate with grassroots conservative voters, as well as Weyrich's and Blackwell's organizing in Washington to promote conservative GOP candidates. As a result, the 1978 elections brought 30 new congressional representatives to Washington, many of them self-identified conservatives. The new class included a former history professor from Georgia with the unlikely name of Newt Gingrich, another CMP. This conservative victory was further cemented 2 years later by the election of former California Governor Ronald Reagan, whom the New Right wholeheartedly supported as a fellow traveler. Ha ha ha. It's a Masonic term, people. Fellow traveler. By knocking the Democratic establishment on its ears, the New Right changed the tenor of politics in Washington, especially for long-suffering conservatives. Weyrich and his colleagues helped remind the right wing of something that seems obvious in retrospect, but was somewhat lost at the time. As Viguerie noted, a few months before the 1978 election, conservatives can win. Two generations of defeat conditioned many conservatives to accept defeat as inevitable. But the nearly frantic liberal reaction to the New Right phenomenon has changed many conservatives' expectations. Most New Right leaders have cheerful, optimistic attitudes. They look for ways to win rather than excuses for losing. Your opposition isn't superhuman. You can win. Viguerie, never one to play down his own role, often hinted that he and his colleagues deserve credit for the Reagan victory. And also Roger Stone would say the same. He wrote in 1981 that America is basically a conservative country. The potential for a conservative revolt has always been there, under the most favorable conditions. But those conditions have to be made. That's where the New Right came in. Still, while his claims might be overblown, it is clear in hindsight that the New Right, at the very least, helped make the Reagan Revolution possible. But beyond their contributions to GOP electoral victories in 1978 and 1980, two other key accomplishments of the coup changed the nature of the Republican Party and American politics even more dramatically. Nixon had heartily mobilized racial grievances of white Americans for the GOP. Since Reagan, conservative politics has also built on appeals to social issues like abortion and gay rights. It was the new right who put these social issues on the GOP agenda, and it was they who brought the chief targets of these policies, the religious right, into the Republican coalition, thus ushering in almost 30 years of conservative dominance over American politics. This is called social conservatives. Conservatism. Another way the new right differed from their old right predecessors was in their recognition of the power and importance of grassroots voters and issues. As Lee Edwards later recalled, there was a populist element, a very strong element, that was not present in the traditional conservatives. The new right was much more consciously populist, which is what Roger Stone and Trump are all building up. It's all popular, populist. The people want this, the hype, the circus. But the new right was only taking advantage of a national trend, again inspired by the 1960s left. Yeah, don't you kind of feel like we're going through that now? Yeah. Roger Stone is calling for, what is it? What is he calling for? Day of Rage for Cleveland to mimic the Chicago riots of 1969, done by the Weathermen and the SDS. Okay. Where was I? But the new right was only taking advantage of a national trend, again inspired by the 1960s left of grassroots actions. I think I just read that. A host of single-issue groups, only some of which identified as conservative, rose up against the country to address a number of issues, from taxes to abortion. The Democrats' growing identification with the liberal social movements of the era made it hard for them to be responsive to many of these issues, but successive Republican administrations were not much help either. The new right harnessed this part of the populist revolt after Nixon and Ford ignored the needs of grassroots anti-tax and other single-issue conservatives. One more paragraph before the break. Weyrich and his colleagues organized a diverse array of interest into a conservative coalition during the 1970s. For example, foreign policy issues were very much on conservatives' minds in the middle of the decade. These included the Panama Canal treaties, opposition to which Viguerie had helped organize, and the fight against global communism. In a recent interview, Phillips recalled that the canal, the SALT, S-A-L-T, arms accord, and the development of nuclear missile defense systems, the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Star Wars program that Reagan eventually funded, were both major concerns of the new right during the period. This foreign policy component helped the new right forge alliances with neoconservative intellectuals who eventually developed Reagan's hardline anti-communism into a coherent foreign policy. And we're going to be hitting a break any moment here, guys. And we're going to finish the rest of this article. Not much more to it. I don't really like reading articles, but this really sets the stage of where I want to go with the show. It's going to be multi-parts. I don't necessarily have to read all of this articles. I really want to bounce into the Council for National Policy, the Knights of Malta, the John Birch Society, and other different groups. Thank you.
These are the top five reasons not to vaccinate. 1. Vaccines have never been proven safe or effective. Vaccine studies funded by pharmaceutical companies compare vaccine side effects from one vaccine to another. 2. Vaccines do not work. They may create a temporary increase in antibodies for a particular disease, but this does not equate to immunity to disease. 3. The very first vaccine was a disaster. Vaccine safety and effectiveness is a created myth, strongly embedded in the American psyche. 4. Vaccines are highly profitable for pharmaceutical companies and the healthcare industry. 5. Every study comparing unvaccinated to vaccinated children demonstrates that unvaccinated children enjoy far superior health.
Oh, welcome back. We're going to finish up this article real quick and get into a lot of these connections with the truth movement, the patriot movement, whatever, the bowel movement, your pro-white movements, the right wing, the alt-right. I don't know why anybody who is into anything that is alternative to the mainstream would still want to use the term right, but they do. Okay, we left off with the concept of social conservatism, and we're back. Still, foreign policy was not the chief concern of the new right. Instead, Weyrich and his colleagues aggressively sought to add so-called social issues to the Republican agenda, hoping to bind related pro-family and socially motivated voters to the party. The social component of the new right was so prominent that Virginia Armstrong, later head of the Court Watch program for Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum, actually defined the group in terms of their social conservatism in 1981. The New Right Coalition, she wrote, was a loose, voluntary coalition of groups united in their objective of reasserting traditional Judeo-Christian principles as the underpinning of American government and politics. Writing for the Journal of Christian Legal Society, Armstrong recognized the importance of economic and foreign policy issues to the group, but argued that moral issues were the most prominent in the 1980 election, in part because of the New Right's efforts. Weyrich, in particular, recognized that an expanding agenda that included such issues would not only mobilize new groups, but could help the Republican Party retain support while the economy it was managing was mired in a severe recession. The new right socially conservative bent was reinforced by Reagan's seemingly and reluctance to act on social issues at the beginning of his presidency. Maybe that's why he was... the assassination attempt actually happened. He wasn't doing what they wanted him to do, and he eventually did. Just a few months after Reagan took office, Vigory publicly warned that conservatives would not back Reagan in a battle over tax cuts for the wealthy that would supposedly promote economic growth. Not because they disagreed with the president's supply-side tax plan, but because they had other priorities. It appeared to Vigory that their chief concerns, abortion, opposition to gay rights and the Equal Rights Amendment, abstinence, education, and other family issues, were starting to be pushed from the GOP agenda. the new right saw themselves as spokesmen for pro-family groups in Washington and accordingly tried to hold the GOP's feet to the fire. And they're basically hypocrites, too, when they say that they're for gay opposition to gay rights. Because during that time, there was already a scandal brewing with homosexual escorts being utilized at the White House for the GOP. And you also had the Franklin cover-up and all that going on. So these people are hypocrites, people. Not all single-issue groups were happy to be incorporated in this fashion. A 1981 Time magazine article suggested that some profile groups, for instance, were troubled by their association with the new right. Roman Catholic groups particularly were uneasy with the new alliance. While opposing abortion, they opposed many other new right positions. For instance, on the economy, Thea Rossi Barron, a lobbyist with the Catholic National Right to Life Coalition, left the organization in the 1970s after it joined the new right in trying to block the Equal Rights Amendment. The pro-life movement needed both conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, to achieve its goals, Barron argued. Still other groups, however, were happy to join up, at least for a time, although she later expressed regrets over the move. Judy Brown's, also largely Roman Catholic, American Life League, was a staunch ally of Weyrich throughout the 1980s. Besides incorporating single-issue groups into the Republican coalition, the other key innovation of the new right was its target of Christian evangelicals, who had been relatively quiescent since the Scopes trial early in the 20th century. Still, there had been signs of a political awakening among evangelicals as early as the 1950s, and the new right again was able to take advantage of existing political trends. In the post-war decades, the political ties of preachers such as Billy Graham helped remind evangelicals of the world of politics. While Graham's friend Richard Nixon made early efforts to court white evangelicals, recognizing their importance to his Southern strategy of wooing Democrats to the GOP. The social causes that spurred the new rights issue groups also pulled in evangelicals as they became more open to political action. Abortion originally was almost the sole concern of Catholic groups until the anti-abortion book and video production of theologian Francis Schaeffer and future Surgeon General C. Everett Koop helped bring the issue to evangelicals in the late 1970s. Another key moment was the Carter administration's effort to rescind the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University because of its racially discriminatory admission policy, an effort eventually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1983. The Internal Revenue, the IRS, also pursued Goldsboro Christian School, which was founded in 1963, with the idea that the mixing of races violated God's plan. These battles helped trigger a revolt amongst white Southern evangelicals who maintained separate religious schools that were functionally exclusionary, even when technically open to all races. Equally important, evangelicals were enraged by feminism and its allies in government, as a number of battles over school textbooks, sex education, and the ERA convinced evangelical women and men that feminists were out to dramatically restructure the American family order. Still, despite all this political commotion, evangelicals were not well organized politically and nowhere near a solid conservative voting bloc. Many had supported Carter in 1976 due to his avowed evangelical faith and identification as born again. The new right, however, hoped to claim evangelicals for its own. Weyrich had been eyeing them as a significant new Republican constituency and for years had tried to convince Southern preachers of the importance of political action. So, the merger of state and religion is happening while we're talking about this, right? It was always supposed to be separate. These people claim they're constitutionalists, but they're merging religion and statehood together, just to note. In 1977, Howard Phillips and Weyrich associate Ed McAteer A former toothpaste salesman turned conservative activist traveled around the country visiting Christian leaders and preachers, attempting to recruit them to this conservative cause. But by far, the most famous meeting occurred in 1978 when Ryrick led a New Right delegation, including Phillips, Howard Phillips, McAteer, and another Ryrick associate and preacher, Bob Billings, to the Virginia coast to recruit a well-known Baptist minister to the New Right. Morton Blackwell later described the genesis of the meeting. We looked at the national politically and theologically conservative leaders, and there were a few of them, and we identified the one most likely to take the lead. We settled on Jerry Falwell. Remember that name? Paul and others went down there, and of course, you know the story that Paul said, "We think there's a moral majority out there." And Falwell said, "I like that name." Paul asked, "What name?" And Falwell said, "Moral majority. That's the name we'll use."
Okay.
The rest is history. The Moral Majority, McAteer's own group, the Religious Roundtable, and other religious associates helped deliver the evangelical vote to Reagan and the GOP. Racially inflected social conservatism became a major component of the Republican coalition, propelling conservative presidential and congressional candidates to victory in subsequent decades and ensuring a sharp right turn in American policymaking. The New Right electoral strategy, paying attention to single issues, especially social ones, became standard operating procedure for the GOP. Aftermath and legacy. One of the reasons why the New Right is so poorly understood today is that the co-founders fell into obscurity shortly after the Reagan victory. By the end of the 1980s, the leadership group had gone their separate ways, no longer a factor in the Republican Party politics. Yeah, bullshit. They were eclipsed by their creation, the religious right. Their decline was partially a result of individual idiosyncrasies. None of these characteristics were more ironic than Terry Dolan's, as revealed when he died of AIDS in 1986, the fundraiser and PAC organizer who had played a direct role in bringing anti-gay issues, hypocrisy issues onto the Republican agenda, was himself a closeted homosexual. Less dramatic, but not less final, was Howard Phillips' eventual break with the Republican Party. Phillips later referred to the early 1980s as the first of Bush's three terms, due to the prominent role of moderates like James Baker in the early Reagan administration, and used his taxpayers' party to make his own failed bid for the presidency in 1996. But the seeds of the New Right's decline may have had more structural origin. Without liberals in government to attack and defeat, what was the point of the New Right? As Lee Edwards later observed, there were more a political movement than a philosophical movement. Their goal was to elect conservatives to the House and Senate. They did that in 1978 and then again in 1980. They knocked off 10 or 12 prominent liberal senators. You elect Reagan in 1980, you've achieved your goals. Now what's your raison d'etre? So they became a critic. Indeed, Richard Viguerie has become one of the Republican Party's most vocal critics on the right. In response to a 2006 Viguerie op-ed critical of then-President Bush, conservative columnist Bob Novak carped that Reagan had been president only 7 days when Viguerie compared him to Jimmy Carter based on his cabinet selections. Novak should have done some more research. According to the Washington Post, Viguerie and Dolan were complaining even earlier, barely 2 weeks after Reagan's election. Viguerie actually foresaw his problematic relationship with the GOP even before the 1980 election. In a Washington Post article from October of that year, he warned that conservatives would likely be stronger if Carter won the election. The New Right couldn't get together when someone whom we've perceived to be one of ours, like Nixon or Ford, was in office. Some 25 years after Reagan's victory, Weyrich took a less belligerent approach to the fading of the New Right, seeing it as a necessary outgrowth of political success. It is an axiomatic, he noted, that when an administration comes into power, it is going to absorb many of the people who brought it to power. He may have been thinking here of Morton Blackwell, who joined the Reagan administration as a liaison to conservative groups like the New Right's Conservative Caucus and Moral Majority. And even as this particular New Right grouping fell by the wayside, Blackwell and especially Weyrich remained plugged into the conservative and Republican networks. And new groups carried the work forward, creating grassroots pressure in the GOP. Weyrich created still more conservative organizations, including the semi-secretive umbrella group, the Council on National Policy, which Blackwell headed for most of the 1990s. As of this writing, Blackwell continues to run the Leadership Institute, a Washington-based training program for conservative student activists and political operatives. And Weyrich's weekly coalition meetings of various activists were almost mandatory for Washington conservatives up until his death last year. Similar leaders may yet emerge, and we're seeing that all the time. While the New Right's Moral Majority was relatively short-lived, lasting only until 1989, it soon gave way to Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, another CNP member, today's Family Research Council, and other Christian political groups, as well as the GOP's decades-long habit of at least paying lip service to social conservatism while mostly advancing their economic agenda. And the alliance has even paid some dividends on social policy issues. Social conservatives may be unhappy about progress on overturning Roe versus Wade, but they have the partial birth ban, the Hyde Amendment, and restrictions on international family planning, although the global gag rule has been repealed under Democratic administrations, including Obama's. Plus, evangelical and other groups have brought into their agenda some of the economic issues dear to Republicans, including tax cuts and Social Security reform. Before the New Right brought social issues into Republican politics, traditionalists were much more wary of trying to seize governmental power by arguing for political action on issues like abortion, school prayer, and creationism. The New Right helped make activist traditionalism a reality. The New Right's influence helped mold the GOP in many ways. The influx of Christian conservatives helped drive moderates out of the party. Pro-choice feminists, for example, were still part of the GOP's big tent during the 1990s, but were eventually pushed out for silence. Gotta love that term, big tent, NPI, alt-right, fuckers, fags, hypocrites, operatives. The New Right is now firmly entrenched in the GOP coalition, and we have the New Right to thank. Thanks, Jews. The recent emergence of socially conservative Sarah Palin as one of the faces of the GOP suggests that the influence of the New Right constituency within the party is only growing. And Michelle Bachmann, and who else? Even as prospects for electoral success seemed uncertain at best, the New Right's hold on GOP politics seems secure. The danger of for Republicans is that with the New Right leaders gone or marginalized, they're not, no one may be left to remind the GOP that more is needed than simply anger and issues. Instead, strategy and political savvy will carry the day, and a new generation of leaders, a new right, ready to take the lead. So far, no one has stepped up forward, but only time will tell. Yeah, we're seeing it now. Whew. All right, that was a good article, just to set the stage and platform for the term New Right and where it originated from and where it comes from and why some people are using it again today when it's not new. All right? Now, I think it's important to talk about the John Birch Society because it is like the precursor to the New Right. And a lot of the members of the John Birch Society are crossovers to the Council for National Policy. So this is an article by Barbara Aho on watchpair.com. With the onset of the McCarthy era 50 years ago, any perceived threat to U.S. sovereignty from the British Roundtable and its American branch shifted to an obsession with the Soviet Union. Ray Cohn, remember that name. That is Fred Trump and Donald Trump's lawyer, okay? So Ray Cohn, who is legal counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the anti-communist Senate investigations of the 1950s, would later become a member of the John Birch Society and a principal figure in the JBS intelligence gathering operation, the Western Goals Foundation, which is the precursor to the Council for National Policy, by the way. One of the later emerged the core, which out of the latter emerged the core group, which in 1981 formed the present Council for National Policy. I jumped ahead. Sorry about that. A consortium of high-level political, corporate, and evangelical leaders, which is the primary coordinating body and funding conduit for the Christian right projects. Okay, a lot of connections, big web, decades of, oh, yeah. Sarah Diamond's book, Roads to Dominion, Right-Wing Movements and Political Power in the United States, notes, before and after the formation of the John Birch Society, corporations played a major role in rallying the public to the anti-communist cause. In 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act granted corporations the right to distribute literature to counter labor unions or union organizing, a movement that they blamed on the communists. To reduce the cost of producing and distributing anti-communist materials, corporations turned to non-profit organizations such as the John Birch Society. By 1963, corporations were spending an estimated $25 million per year on anti-communist literature. Some corporations circulated print and audiovisual materials produced by the John Birch Society. Other corporations produced their own in-house literature. By the early 1960s, The Nation magazine reported that there was a minimum of 6,600 corporate-financed anti-communist broadcasts carried by more than 1,300 radio and television stations at a total annual budget of about $20 million. Leading sponsors, including Texas oil billionaire H.L. Hunt and Howard J. Pugh of Sun Oil, the corporate sector's massive anti-communist propaganda campaigns created a favorable climate for the mobilization of activist groups like the John Birch Society. On the other hand, or rather, the other side of the dialectic, supercapitalists such as John D. Rockefeller would come to understand the potential of using labor unions to corporate advantage as a means of controlling the opposition. The Rockefeller interests have not overlooked and have made good use of the monopoly of labor that is afforded to unions to affect monopolies of industry that would be recognized as illegal if they had been affected by a monopoly of machinery. Labor unions have proved to be a powerful weapon for the Rockefeller Empire in extending its world conquest. And subsidized unioneers are always in the forefront of the emissaries that they send out into newly conquered territories. With Marxism as a shibboleth, they are rapidly accomplishing a worldwide subjugation of the peasantry. This has earned for Wiley John D. Jr. a reputation for liberalism. It is more appropriately called Rockefellerism. And the long march towards a new social order, ultra-right, and left-wing agitation propaganda served not only to polarize and destabilize society, they create a diversionary conflict to prevent recognition of the true conspiracy. Lest an informed and united citizenry form an alliance against them, principles of conflict and management are employed by the power elites. The plan, I think, is the old one of world dominion in a new form. These are quotes. The money power and revolutionary power have been set up and given sham by symbolic shapes, capitalism or communism, and sharply defined sidels, America or Russia, such as the spectacle publicly staged for the masses, left, right, Republican, Democrat, right? Blue versus red, red team, blue team. But what if similar men with a common aim secretly rule in both camps and propose to achieve their ambition through the clash between those masses? I believe any diligent student of our times will discover that is the case. Quote by Douglas Reed. In his essay on the unseen hand behind this age of conflict, Ivor Benson reveals the natural partnership that exists between ostensibly opposing forces. For example, the fascist Rhodes-Milner Roundtable and Fabian Socialists to secure a common objective, namely the subjugation of mankind. Significantly, Julius Warner of the Warner-Beit conglomerate that supported Milner's effort to precipitate the Anglo-Boer War contributed substantially to the funding of the London School of Economics and socialist movements everywhere and vehemently anti-capitalist. Continued to receive massive support from the most powerful capitalists. It was because of the absence of any fundamental antagonism between the philosophies of John Ruskin and of Karl Marx that it was possible for the brave New World ambition, so actively promoted by Rhodes and his heirs, to be absorbed into the socialist world power vortex with hardly a sign that anything untoward had happened. In fact, the international socialist instruments of the most highly concentrated financial power were able to take over the Rhodes-Milner establishment, complete with its worldwide network of organizations, the Rhodes Scholarship Trust, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilaterals, etc., and continue to run it as if still under its original management. Indeed, it simply gave the socialists a new dimension for the exercise for their incomparable skill in the arts of deception. Carol Quigley and colleagues of like sympathy with the Rhodes agenda have widely propagated the belief that the American branch of the Roundtable organization is exclusively the liberal Eastern establishment. We'll be back. We're going to be covering the Belmont Brotherhood next, the John Birch Society, and some other groups. Stay tuned.
Said I kissed away her tears, my fond arm round her flinging, when a foreman shuffle stung our rears, from out the wild woods ringing, a bullet pierced my true love's side, in life's end.
And now a word from the real boss of Renegade Broadcasting. You thought it was a man, but it's really a baby.
You're listening to Renegade.
Translation, you're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
I love white people.
Translation, I love white people. And when asked what his favorite show is, he replied,
I also don't.
Translation, Firestarter Radio. Check it out at 8 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome back, everybody, and we're going to continue this read, and we're going to start at the Belmont Brotherhood revealed that the Anglo-American establishment, which represents the interests of the aforesaid corporations, also launched the ultra-conservative movement in the United States, the John Birch Society being a pioneer of the extreme right of this dialectic process. Produced in 1977 by a group of former high-ranking JBS members, the Belmont Brotherhood refers to the National Council of Belmont, Massachusetts, where the JBS national headquarters were originally located. They're over in Wisconsin now. Various sources cited therein document that the early members of the John Birch Society were also members of the liberal establishment they pretended to oppose, and represented the great measure, the corporate interests of America, which are advanced by the oaths of loyalty to one another in a secret brotherhood, organized Freemasonry. This 12-page report concluded with the perceptive observation that the John Birch Society represents the most diabolical form of the Illuminati conspiracy. All right, here's a quote. You may object, look at all the great things founder Robert Welch has done. He has exposed the Illuminati. Baloney. The Illuminati was merely a branch of the conspiracy. Now, how can one attack the Illuminati without attacking the diabolical power behind it, organized Freemasonry? Welch has provided the most valuable service of all time to the conspiracy. He founded an organization to neutralize millions of American people from discovering what the true power behind the Illuminati really was. And we concede the Masons' choice an extremely clever man to do the job. Welch, with the help of the Belmont Brotherhood, plays his role very effectively. The introduction to a 1967 reprint of John Robinson's Proofs of a Conspiracy, which is what Alex Jones said he read early on and got him into this movement, which was a 1789 expose of the Illuminati, published by the Birch-owned Western Islands publisher. This allowed that there could be present connections between the Illuminati and Freemasonry. According to the JBS, the Illuminati are the fourth fathers of communism, but not of Freemasonry, which is held in the highest regard as a patriotic organization by the John Birch Society. Robeson, a former Mason himself, found that this impunity from authority by maintaining the Masonic rule of secrecy had gradually encouraged men of licentious principles to become more bold and to teach doctrines subversive of all our notions of morality. Let us be quick to say that Freemasonry in England, America, and elsewhere has historically and today is quite another kind, and its members characterized by high standards of morality and spirituality. The true purpose of the Illuminati order was to rule the world. To achieve this, it was necessary for the order to destroy all religions, overthrow all governments, and abolish private property. This is exactly what the communists have been doing since 1848. Please note that Robeson makes it clear that the Illuminati order was quite distinct and separate from Freemasonry. The conspiracy was conceived not by Masons as Masons, but by evil men using Freemasonry as a vehicle for their own purposes. In the realm of ideology, certainly the line of from the Illuminati Order to the Communist Manifesto is straight and unbroken. Let it be stressed that the present publication of Robison's work is not intended to open old wounds or create new animosity or distrust towards Freemasonry, whose adherents today certainly number among our staunchest patriots and anti-communists. The conspirators have long since discarded Freemasonry as their vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
If clever conspirators could use, of all groups, so fine as a group as the Masons, we must open our minds to consider what infinite possibilities are available to them in our own present-day society. Their main habitat these days seems to be the great subsidized universities, tax-free foundations, mass media communications, government bureaus such as the State Department, and a myriad of private organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations. Contrary to the JBS position on Freemasonry are the facts of history, Freemasonry has proven itself over centuries to be a secret society which foments revolution wherever it establishes a base of operation. That Masonry binds its initiates to a code of conduct, and antithetical to patriotism is the subject of a lengthy and well-documented series titled America's Subversion, The Enemy Within. Facts substantiated by the writings of Masonic scholars and determined by U.S. state legislature investigations provide abundant proof that within the United States there is a fifth column dedicated to the overthrow of its constitutional government. The Constitution of Freemasonry, written in 1721 by Dr. John Anderson of Aberdeen, Scotland, laid the groundwork for universal treason rather than loyalty to country. James Anderson's son, Dr. James Anderson, in 1721, went about rewriting Freemasonry's constitutions for the Grand Lodge of England. However, the precedents for obstruction and perversion of justice would later be documented in Freemasonry's expansion to American soil, both in a structure of oaths and in practice. American soil would also witness the murder of Captain Morgan, who revealed Masonic secrets to the public, who was murdered pursuant to Masonic oaths of retribution. Such oaths include to the Royal Ark degree, the concealment of crimes by fellow Masons, murder and treason not accepted. Dr. James Anderson's improvements to written constitutions of the time in England have evidently not so much altered the underlying substance of Freemasonry as it has in serving the interests of providing a strategic or tactical move at its time. Dr. James Anderson was born in Aberdeen in about 1680. After becoming a minister in the Church of Scotland, he made his way to England. In 1721, he started rewriting Masonry's constitution in a new and better method. He claimed he was asked to do this by the new Grand Lodge of England, founded in 1717 when four lodges came together under one authority, but he may have suggested to himself. Page 36, Inside the Brotherhood by Martin Short, 1989. Masonry's Aberdeen spirit had entrenched itself on American soil. Oaths of secrecy, oaths swearing penalties of death for breaches of secrecy, oaths swearing to obstruct and pervert justice, oaths. Okay, I already read all this, but they just repeated themselves. Okay, so here's the Western Gold Foundation that was founded by Larry McDonald. John Birch Society founder Robert Welsh was succeeded upon his death in 1983 by the former congressman Larry McDonald. Lawrence Patton McDonald was a cousin of George S. Patton Jr., the famous general who was killed in an automobile accident at the conclusion of World War II. Yeah, right. Kind of sounds like Jim Trafficant too, right? That mysterious death. So, after that, according to Conspiracies of World War II by J.S. Craig, the common rumor in Germany at the time was that Patton was assassinated due to his wish to join forces with Germany and attack Russia. Patton had openly admitted that the Allies had defeated the wrong enemy and repeatedly praised German industry and the discipline of its people. E.H. Cookridge also recorded General Patton's pro-Nazi attitude and subsequent demise, and Galen's Spy of the Century, an expose of the CIA's recruitment of high-level Nazi espionage agents. Okay. We're going to skip down. 1979, General Patton's cousin, Lawrence McDonald, founded the Western Goals Foundation in Arlington, Virginia, as a front for the JBS network. McDonald directed the organization until his untimely death in the downing of the Korean airliner Cal 007 in 1983. The year he had also succeeded Robert Welch as JBS chairman. Western Goals was discontinued in 1986 following a power struggle for McDonald's position. According to the Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center, GroupWatch, files of which are available on the IRC database, Western Goals had worked with Reinhard Gehlen, I guess. McDonald formed a foundation branch in Western Germany in 1981. The organization called the American European Strategy Research Institute was set up with a 130,000 injection from the U.S. office. That figure represented more than a third of Western Gold's operating budget at the time. The German affiliate is Western Gold's Europe EV. This German branch is also known as the American European Strategy Institute. It acknowledges working with Reinhard Gehlen, a former Nazi who had been honored by the elite lay Catholic organization, the Knights of Malta, SMOM, Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Remember that. SMOM gave its highest award of honor, the Grand Croce al Merito Complaca, to Galen in 1948. Galen, who was not a Catholic, was awarded the award because of his efforts in the crusade against godless communism. Galen headed Adolf Hitler's spy operations against the Soviet Union during World War II. After the war, he and his spy apparatus, staffed mostly by former Nazis, were recruited by the CIA. He became the first director of the BND, Western Germany's intelligence agency. Western Goals drew on both private and official government files to become one of the largest and most influential private intelligence operations in the United States. According to GroupWatch, Western Goals was able to bypass legal restraints placed on government intelligence agencies. Well, that's because of their sovereign military order status that gives you diplomatic immunity, by the way. Groups like Western Goals allow the ultra-right to keep tabs on its subversive domestic opposition. In Western Goals' case, this service was apparently not performed only for like-minded private groups. Elton Manzione quotes an East Coast police intelligence source as saying that the Western Goals had a reputation of acting as a clearinghouse for some police departments whose intelligence collecting functions were restricted by laws, such as the Freedom of Information Act. Manzione noted that both the CIA and NSA have received information from John Rees' Information Digest, according to a 1976 investigation by the New York Assembly's Office of Legislative Oversight. Information Digest was supplying information to the FBI, CIA, and the NSA. The internal spying nature of the John Birch Society became known when its espionage against private citizens and the connection with the LA Police Department was discovered. That was also the ADL doing that, too. The final straw for the police commission occurred 2 months earlier when it was discovered that files previously ordered destroyed had been squirreled away by the intelligence officer J. Paul with the approval of his superiors. Investigators with search warrants seized 90 cartons of files from his mobile home and other locations. Paul was in the process of feeding this data into the computers of Western Goals, a private organization headed by Congressman Larry McDonald, and was also involved with Research West, an operation founded by ex-FBI agents, which sold information to corporations. Typical of the files in these cartons was a four-decade dossier on a state Supreme Court judge compiled to assess his possible bias against police intelligence practices. One of the earliest members of the Western Goals Foundation and its principal espionage agent was Birch Society member John Rees, whose Information Digest supplied information to the FBI and CIA and the NSA. Okay. And instrumental in obtaining Rees' entrance to Western goals was J. Peter Grace, who was also chairman of the Order of the Knights of Malta in the United States. President of W.R. Grace and Company from 1945 until 3 years before his death in 1995, Peter Grace is profiled in the Who's Who in America, which lists among his credentials Bachelor of Arts from Yale, Assistant Secretary at W.R. Grace, 1936, President and CEO, 1945, Neocomian Society, Council on Foreign Relations, Knights of Malta, American Chapter of the Board of Founders, Knights of Malta President, Address, 1114 Avenue of the Americas. Okay, we're going to get into Knights of Malta here. Considering that the Neocomian Society and CFR, to which J. Peter Grace belonged, were branches of Cecil Rhodes Eugenics Club, the Round Table, it is not out of character that Grace would be involved in Project Paperclip, a post-World War II CIA arrangement to remove classified information from dossiers so that former SS members and several scientists could immigrate to the U.S. Hundreds of war criminals would find employment within government agencies and companies such as W.R. Grace Chemical Company. The Covert Action Information Bulletin documents the close relationship between Reinhard Gehlen, the CIA, the Knights of Malta, the Vatican, now a Rothschild front, which had smuggled criminals out of Europe through the infamous rat lines. Okay, we all know about Paperclip. The CIA also funded the SMOM fronts, Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe. The president head of the order in the United States is a prominent businessman, J. Peter Grace. Prior to 1971, Grace was associated with Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe, both of which had been established by Gehlen and funded by the CIA. And this describes the manner of Radio Liberty under the supervision of Grace and other prominent figures function as a front for the Nazis. Okay, we're talking about, 1950, the American Committee for Liberation from Bolshevism was created. The trustees included J. Peter Grace, Charles Edison, William Henry Chamberlain, H. J. Hines II, Isaac Don Levine, and Eugene Lyons. The committee, now known as Radio Liberty, under the guiding hand of the CIA's Frank Wisner, funded numerous emigre research institutes, which, according to John Loftus, were little more than front groups for intelligence officers. The Sovereign Military Order of Malta, comprised of several thousand knights in Europe, North, Central, and South America. The origin of the SMM predates the Crusades, which began in the 12th century. According to the KAIB, Knights of Malta participated in the Crusades along with Knights Templar and Teutonic Knights. Order of St. John recruited successfully among the European aristocracy and soon controlled extensive estates throughout the continent, assimilating those previously belonged to the Knights Templar, which had helped crush during the first two decades of the 14th century, with the Templar leadership burned alive as heretics. A lot of them actually escaped and went to Scotland, by the way. It may be more accurate to say that the Templars had become a more criminal element whose dishonorable conduct required a change of personnel, and therefore the mantle and holdings of the Templars were passed to the Knights of Malta. I do agree with that. The Templars were unintelligent and therefore unsuccessful Jesuits, from what Albert Pike has said. Although the Sovereign Military Order of Malta operates under the aegis of the Roman Catholic Church, the latter has become a front for the House of Rothschild, which explains why the Knights of Malta include prominent figures in business and government. And the SMOM interlocks with other high-level organizations of infamous reputation. Specifically, the Knights of Malta, Italian Masonic Lodge P2, and Holy Roman Empire Restorationists, the Prior Scion, have all been proven to be linked to the hierarchy of the Vatican, Global members of these groups participate at the highest levels of military, international politics, and finance. P2, Propaganda 2, are perhaps the most visible and are named after the propaganda machine of Joseph Goebbels that effectively mind-controlled the German people into believing their Rosicrucian racist ideology that led to the Holocaust. Okay. Whew. All right. Well, okay. In addition to Casey and James Buckley, its current members of Knights of Malta after the feudal fashion included Lee Iacocca, John McCone, William Buckley, Alexander Haig, Alexandra de Merchenis, the chief French intelligence under Giscard d'Estaing. I can't even pronounce that. Himself and Knights of Malta. Otto von Habsburg, of various leaders of the P2 Masonic Lodge in Italy. And Kissinger was also part of that, as well as, come to me. While its organizational funding is relatively modest, its leverage is maximized by the presence of the Knights in key positions in other private and governmental structural structures throughout the world. Okay, so the Knights of Malta, they're diplomatic. They have their own passports. You have to, like Pat Buchanan, he's one of those. You have to pay a membership fee. You are part of the club. You can't be persecuted. You can't. You have free movement. You're basically an agent. A lot of your CIA directors have always been Knights of Malta. They are immune from persecution. I'm going to skip over. I know Prescott Bush was one of those too. He was a Knight of Malta. All right, so William Simon and Prescott Bush, members of the Knights of Malta. Simon was also on Pradomka's National Council. Both Pradomka and the Knights of Malta were involved in efforts to support the Contras and private sector opposition groups in Nicaragua. Simon was Treasury Secretary under Richard Nixon, was also the chairman of the Nicaraguan Freedom Fund, NFF, a fundraising organization set up in 1985, by the Washington Times, a newspaper owned by the Unification Church, which was owned by Reverend Sun Yat-moon, by the way, who was crowned as the new Christ by the Bush administration. The NFF was established to raise funds for the Contras. Okay. I want to skip. Major General John Singlob became CIA Deputy Director in South Korea during the Korean War. He's also CMP, by the way, and served for 2 years in Vietnam during the 1960s. At this time, he was commander at the Joint Unconventional Warfare Task Force, known as MACSOG. In that role, he was one of the commanders of Operation Phoenix, although he denies having had any part in that program's infamous assassination and counter-terror aspects. 1978, as Chief of Staff of the United Nations Command in South Korea, he publicly condemned the decision of President Jimmy Carter to reduce the number of U.S. troops in the country. He was then forced to retire. Operation Phoenix was a terrorist and drug operation in Southwest Asia, which would form the experimental basis for the latter theater of operation of Latin America. Professional assassinations manager Felix I. Rodriguez met with Bush aide Donald P. Gregg, officially and secretly at the White House. Gregg then recommended to National Security Council advisor Robert Bud McFarlane a plan for El Salvador-based military attacks on a target of Central American nations, including Nicaragua. McFarlane said the attached plan, written in March of last year, grew out of two experiences, anti-Viet Cong operations run under my direction in Three Corps, Vietnam, from 1970 to 72. These operations, based on a small elite force, produced very favorable results. Felix Rodriguez followed the CIA boss Ted Shackley to Southeast Asia in 1970. Shackley and Donald Gray put Rodriguez into the huge assassination and dope business, which Shackley and his colleagues ran during the Indochina War. This bunch became the heart of the enterprise that went into action 15 to 20 years later in Iran-Contra. Shackley funded opium-growing Mayo tribesmen and murder and used the dope proceeds to turn to fund his hit squads. He formed the Military Alliance Group Special Operations Group, MAGSOG, Political Murder Unit. General John K. Singlob was a commander of that. Oliver North, CNP, and Richard Secord were officers of the unit. By 1971, the Shackley Group had killed about 100,000 civilians in Southeast Asia as part of the CIA's Operation Phoenix. Okay, take a break. We're going to talk about the World Anti-Communist League, founded in 1666. We're backtracking. This all, it's decades. It's all connected. All right. The first American League chapter of the World American Communist League was the American Council for World Freedom, ACWF, founded in 1970 by Lee Edwards, former director of Young Americans for Freedom, the youth organization of the John Birch Society. Edwards attracted many members of the New Right, such as Reed Irving and Richard Vigoret, also Unification Church President Neil Solonen. When the ACWF resigned from the WACL in 1975 due to mistrust from the Latin American League, convicted Nazi collaborator and racialist Briton Roger Pearson served as the American League president for 3 years. Pearson had traveled in New Right circles for many years, formerly as an editorial associate for such mainstream organizations as the Heritage Foundation and the American Security Council. And on the other hand, he is a white supremacist who warns of the dangers of whites breeding with inferior stock and bragged to an associate with his alleged role in hiding Joseph Mengele. Okay. All right, we're talking about some conspiracy theories here now, right? Okay, Pearson, a member of the British Eugenics Society, was educated at the London School of Economics, which was funded by fellow eugenics Henry Ford, they're blaming on, and the Fabian Society for the purpose of training an elite caste to govern a new social order. Obtaining his Bachelor's of Science in Anthropology from the University of London in 1951 and his Master's in Economics in 1954, Pearson showed an early interest in eugenics. He wrote several books on the subject, including Eugenics and Race and Civilization. Pearson was relocated to the United States in 1965 by Willis Carto, head of the anti-Semitic Liberty Lobby, and became editor of Carto's magazine, Western Destiny, which then became American Free Press and whatnot. Roger Pearson's successor as head of the American WACL was John Singlob again, whose high-level government connections restored an appearance of respectability to WACL, serving on the advisory board was such nobles as Howard Phillips again of Conservative Caucus, Andy Messing of the National Defense Council, and Fred Schlafly, husband of Phyllis Schlafly of Eagle Forum. Okay, we're headed to a break. A lot of connections we're making here with these people.
Divide and conquer was never about placing a line between whites and blacks. That was always going to naturally happen because we are so different. It was always about whites being turned against fellow whites.
Racist this and racist that. You don't hear blacks calling each other racists, but you do hear whites calling other whites racist. You also hear white men calling white women bitches and white women calling white men pigs. It's time to cut the shit.
White men
and white women
need to become white men
and white women again. Because at the moment, white women are no longer white women.
And white men are no longer white men.
It's okay to be a lady.
It's okay to be a man.
It's okay to be white.
Welcome back, everybody. And we have a half an hour left, and I would like if Sean would extend it another hour if he could. I would really appreciate that. I do want to touch upon the Council for National Policy a little bit more further after I get into a lot of these connections. Sean said he's on it. He's going to take care of that for me. So you guys get an extra hour, and thank you, Sean, for all the hard work you do. Please throw some money towards Sean and Kyle. They do hell of a work. Kyle recently called into Portland Community College to talk about their Whiteness History Month. And we need more people like Kyle who do activism in that fashion. The more we attack and the message of anti-whiteness, the more we get our voice heard and we can eradicate the anti-whites and their narrative. Okay. We're going to still connect the Central American operations to these groups like the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly, Council for National Policy, and these anti-communist groups that are all fronts for global domination. We have people in the alt-right who praise the CIA for overthrowing leaders. And, you know, I don't get it. They don't see the big picture. They're too obtuse, I've said to others on Twitter, to see the big picture. So, there's other people that I want to talk about. Lieutenant General Daniel O'Graham, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and former member of the advisory board of CAUSA, the political arm of Sun Young Moon's Unification Church. You could do a whole show on Sun Young Moon's Unification Church, by the way. With the help of Oliver North, John Singlob would enable the contra-resistance in Nicaragua, assisting David Rockefeller and J. Peter Grace with the corporate takeover of Latin America. In 1984, Singlob headed a Pentagon panel called to make recommendations and conducting military activities in Central America. The panel's report urged the U.S. to emphasize non-conventional counterinsurgency warfare strategies. Under the Reagan administration, what a good guy. Singlob received assistance and guidance from the White House and National Security Council, NSC, officials for his private contra-supply activities. He identified former NSC aide Oliver North as his liaison to the White House. And Oliver North happened to be on Alex Jones' show before, too. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. Great guy. A diagram found in Oliver North's safe showed Western Gulls executive director Linda Gould's name written above the words Western Gulls. The note on the diagram said that Gould worked with C8 USA, the political arm of the Unification Church, and its head, Bo Hi Pak, and made trips to Germany and South Korea. The word money was written over Gould's name with an arrow pointing to Rob Owen, North's courier to the Contras. Arrows were also drawn from Owen's name to Gould's and from Andy Messing, a private Contra supporter and head of the National Defense Council Foundation, to Western Gulls. The diagram was drawn at the bottom of the letter from Fawn to Hall, from Fawn Hall to Phil Mabry and Randy, dated April 18, 1985. Gould is now working with John Singlob at the Singlob Freedom Foundation. Daniel Graham, Lieutenant General Graham, is director of the defense lobby High Frontier. He is also a member of the World Anti-Communist League, an organization which until recently was headed by John Singlob. Graham is a former member of the advisory board of CAUSA, the political arm of Sun Yat-moon. Daniel Graham has written pamphlets for Western Gulls. Graham is former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. John Singlob, Daniel Graham, and Mildred Jefferson are members of the National Policy Board of the American Freedom Coalition, a political organization with extensive ties to the Unification Church. Larry McDonald, John Rees, and Sherman Eckefer were members of the John Birch Society. Sherman Eckefer served as an advisory to Chile's regime under Augusto Pinochet, who the outright likes to praise, too. He's just so fashy. Yeah. Eckefer reportedly worked closely with Chile's secret police organization, DINA. Mildred Jefferson, John Singlob, Daniel Graham, and Mildred Jefferson are members of the National Policy Board of Freedom Coalition. I already talked about that. Dr. Mildred Faye Jefferson, physician, President Right to Life Crusade, National Right to Life Foundation, trustee, St. Louis University, diplomat, American Board of Surgery, Father Flanagan Award, Boys Town, Nebraska. Franklin cover-up, Boys Town, Nebraska. Graduate, Harvard Medical School, honorary degrees from 26 institutions. Here's a subtitle. Financing Revolution. Funding for the U.S. branch of the World Anti-Communist League has come from beer baron Joseph Coors and Texas oil billionaires Nelson Bunker Hunt and William Herbert Hunt. In 1966, H.L. Hunt was approached for funding Vatican anti-communist operations in Latin America, a project in conjunction with the Unification Church, which he discussed in a later interview. I was approached by Paolo Cardinal Marella, who said he spoke for the Pope and asked if I would supply members of my 20,000-member Youth Freedom Speakers movement, who spoke Spanish, to be sent south to Latin America to engage in speech-making and activities. I was told the Pope was thinking in terms of $11 million a year support for the entire movement against communism in Spanish-speaking countries. The project was now centered in New York at the Asian Speakers Bureau with the Free Pacific Association, Inc., on Riverside Drive, another front for the Reverend Sun Yat-moon's Unification Church. Funding for the Western Gulls Foundation was provided by corporations and wealthy John Birch Society members, primary benefactor being Nelson Bunker Hunt. Another major funder of Western Gulls was industrialist Roger Milliken, a member of the JBS and the board of directors of W.R. Grace Company. Deering Milliken and Deering Milliken Research Corporations also funded Western Gulls. Now we're going to get into the Council for National Policy. Nelson Bunker Hunt's membership in the John Birch Society is mentioned in ominous politics with reference reference to the Texas billionaires' contribution to the moral majority. These people, they funnel money to all these different think tanks and NGOs and operation groups. Hunt, whose Birch Society background is documented by Conway and Siegelman in Holy Terror, also made a contribution of $1 million to the moral majority in 1981, according to Peter Dean Young. In the same year, William Herbert and Nelson Bunker Hunt provided the startup money for the Council for National Policy, a highly secretive coalition which represents the entire spectrum of new right, corporate executives, TV preachers, and former high-ranking officials and military leaders. The Council for National Policy is considered the primary coordinating body and funding conduit for the Christian right projects. Nelson Bunker Hunt, who was president of the Council for National Policy in 1982 to 83, is among several of the John Birch Society Western Goals Foundation principals and associates who also served on the newly formed CNP Board of Directors. Singlob, Graham, and Jefferson were members of the Board of Governors for the Council for CNP, we're not going to keep repeating that. The CNP. Sherman Unkerfer, Hans Sundholz, and Robert Stoddard, the group's financier backers. Nelson Bunker Hunt is on CNP's board too, as was Larry McDonald, who people think was a hero of some sort. Oliver North has also been a member of the CNP since its inception. Robert Stoddard is also listed as part of the Belmont Brotherhood as chairman board of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, whose editors belong to the local committee of the CFR. There's a lot of cross memberships going on with the left and right, with the CFR and the CNP. Then we have Howard Phillips of the USCWF. We've been talking about Howard Phillips. Board is chairman of the Conservative Caucus and on the board executive committee of the Council for National Policy. Major W.F. Andy Messing Jr., ASAR, retired. Former chair of the Conservative Caucus is on the USWCF board, on the board of Council for National Policy, and was the head of the National Defense Council Foundation. J. Peter Gray, CFR, we talked about him, was also on the board of directors for the CMP. Anna Knight of Malta. William Simon and Prescott Bush Jr. are also members of the Knights of Malta, and Simon was also on, we already talked about Simon. Okay, why do they keep talking about these same people? Frank Shakespeare, U.S. Information Agency Director and Director of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty during Reagan administration, served as ambassador to Portugal in 1985 to 1987, and then as ambassador to the Vatican, chairman of the Heritage Foundation, where your patriots praise that group. Also has served in executive positions in the communications industry for more than 30 years. Former president of CBS. Dr. Edward Teller, CFR, also CNP, was a Hungarian Jew, they don't say for some reason, American physicist who became the architect of the hydrogen bomb. During the World War II, he was a member of the Manhattan Project for the development of the atomic bomb. Teller was a member of the Citizens Legal Defense Fund for the FBI, ad hoc, an advisor to the Western Goals Foundation, member of the CFR, and member and board of the CNP. Another major benefactor of the Council for National Policy is 33rd degree Mason Richard DeVos, president of Amway Corporation, who has also funded the Aspen Global Change Institute. DeVos serves as the judge for the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. On the board of directors of 33rd Degree Mason Robert Schuller Ministries, and as a trustee of 33rd Degree Mason Gerald R. Ford Foundation. DeVos is also a member of the New Komen Society and the Roundtable. We talked about Nelson Bunker Hunt, financier, executive officer of the Religious Roundtable, Campus Crusade, and JBS, and main funder, second president of the CMP. And Jesse Helms, we brought up earlier, whose top political operative, Tom Ellis, was director of the Racial Eugenics Pioneer Fund and second CMP president. We're members of a racial eugenics society, the International Association for Advancement of Eugenics and Ethnology. Happens to be located in Scotland. Masonic. We're going to skip over. The Belmont Brotherhood documents that the founding JBS National Council was entrenched in the Eastern establishment. It purported to despise. Nor is it progeny or the Council for National Policy, a conservative anti-communist organization, but rather a globalist organization, anti-American and unpatriotic and extreme, noting the curious crossover tendencies between right and left in the World Anti-Communist League. Authors of Inside League offer the following insightful analysis. The first enemy for political extremes is the center. Both ultra-lefts and ultra-rightists have the same primary objective, to polarize the country, to implement the breakdown of the governing system and ultimately create a situation of chaos where armed conflict will be between the right and the left, the center having been discredited by its failure to prevent it. Little wonder that terrorist after terrorist and terrorism expert after terrorism expert have agreed that the purpose of both red and black terror is to destroy the open democratic forms of liberal government and to replace them with something elitist and totalitarian. Go fascism! Yes. Rightist terror seeks the brutal intervention of repressive forces. Leftist terror seeks the same, believing that only complete repression will bring a self-satisfied quiet bourgeoisie to a flashpoint, a revolutionary critical mass. This is the objective of the World Anti-Communist League. Then it goes a long way toward explaining the strange alliances it has formed. It is this very pursuit of international polarization and its ability to embrace openly leftist elements in an anti-communist cause that have led many to speculate about the League's true nature. Some have even suggested a secret sponsorship of the League by the Soviet Union or other communist governments, employing it as the ultimate agent provocateur, which there is something to that. We've been talking about Dugin and his connections with the NPI and Cuba having been communist and Russians, the Soviets over there, and now the floodgates are open for Cubans to come on in. I just saw an image of Ted Cruz's father next to the fuck's his name? The patsy for World War or for the JFK assassination. I can't even believe I forgot his name. Anyways, yeah, Ted Cruz's father, Cuban, part of the communist regime, in a photo right before JFK assassination. So, we contend that Soviet communism was merely one phase of the global dialectic, fascism and communism being two expressions of the same conspiracy. Nicholas Murray Butler for the English-speaking Union has informed us. Communism is the tool by which Britain's international finance is knocking down national governments in the interest of world government, world police, and world currency. The true conspirators are identified in the new unhappy lords. If the facts concerning the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations be accepted, it will be seen that the proper study of political mankind is the study of power elites, without which nothing that happens can be understood. These elites, preferring to work in private, are rarely found posed for photographers, and their influence upon events has therefore to be deduced from what is known of the agencies they employ. They are dozens of such agencies, and financial support received from one or another or all three big American foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford, provides an infallible means of recognizing them. The real conspiracy is neither exclusively communist nor fascist, but elitist, inexorably moving society through progressive deconstruction and redefinition to a third-way society, in which a partnership of government and business will subjugate and control an enslaved workforce to serve its own purposes. That the final word empire, world empire, is a composite of these forms is a concept which finds basis in Bible prophecy, specifically the hybrid beast of Daniel. And I think that the Bible, personally myself, is being used as a blueprint to make all of this actually happen. So these prophecies, they were written for that time period, whatever had occurred back then, and Christians today say that they are coming into fruition because of Bible prophecy, but I believe it's just a blueprint that they're going off of, like the Protocols of Zion and the Communist Manifesto. The Masonic axiom, Ordo ab Chao, Order of Chaos, will find a measure of fulfillment in Daniel 7:7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Okay. I'm going to get into an article written by a leftist site. I hate that term. Daily Kos. The Sith Lords of the Ultra-Right. Ever wonder how the right always seems so coordinated in the strategy? How all the multitude of organizations they've created all seem to use the same playbook? How they all manage to focus on the same talking points each day, day after day, year after year? Well, it's no accident. But how do they know? How do they do it? The answer, my friends, lies in a little-known organization with the innocuous-sounding name, the Council for National Policy. Don't go looking for any official website because you won't find one, which is not true. There is one. This was written in 2005. Real quick. I'm going to read from the Council for National Policy website. About us, a handful of men and women, individuals of character, had a vision to see the return of righteousness, justice, and truth to our great nation. Ronald Reagan remarks to CNP's 10th anniversary celebration. The Council for National Policy brings together the country's most influential conservative leaders in business, government, politics, religion, and academia to hear and learn from policy experts on a wide range of issues. In addition, we provide a forum that allows an open exchange between participants, presenting numerous opportunities to cultivate ideas to help solve America's growing problems. To help educate the American public, CNP hosts an online journal of speaker presentations called Policy Council. This incredible resource features the best and brightest minds on economics, defense and foreign policy, and social issues. Okay. And they are a 501c3. They are located on K Street in Washington, D.C. They also have another group called CNP Action Inc., which is a 501c4 sister organization. And for they promote issues or basic specific pieces of legislation through regular publications and standing committee workshops. Publications, Heard Around the Hill, a monthly newsletter that highlights the activities of CNP Action Inc., coalition projects by conservative groups around the country, upcoming legislation of importance to conservatives, and any additional information to help advance the principle of economic freedom, traditional values, and a strong national defense. Media Guide, a comprehensive listing of contact information for daily and weekly newspaper publications nationwide. Action Sessions. The goal of the Action Sessions is to strategize on a given issue and arrive at a unified path of action to be taken by all present in an effort to maximize our impact. What others are saying. Since 1981, no other organization has come close to being as useful as the Council for National Policy in making it possible for a wide range of powerful conservatives to work effectively together. CNP Action Inc., its lobbying arm, is CNP's key to making things happen politically. Morton Blackwell, founder and president of the Leadership Institute. Another one. CNP Action Inc. has the ear of the nation's most influential conservative leaders and works to provide information and encourage their actions on significant legislative issues. Edwin Meese III, former U.S. Attorney General. CNP Action Inc. is a very specific vehicle for conservative leaders to make their voices heard on policies and legislation important to the survival of the American Constitutional Republic. Phyllis Schlafly, president of the Eagle Forum. So yes, the website does exist today. CFNP.org. One more hour. We'll see you on the other side.
Okay, little Jimmy. As a four-year-old child, I trust your judgment to make life-altering decisions about your body and gender. But where can I get some help for this?
Well, we can help. Here at the Michelle Obama Academy for Transgender Children, we will convince you and your child that gender is just a social construct. Bruce Jenner knows that just because you were born with a penis, that doesn't mean you need to be a boy. It means that you need to chop it off and get a neo-vagina. At Michelle Obama's Academy for Transgender Kids, we know the importance of chopping off genitals.
Stepped up one November day when I was on.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome back, everybody, for hour number three. We're reading from The Sith Lords of the Ultra Right, written in 2005. Here's a quote real quick from Paul Wyrick. We are no longer working to preserve the status quo. We are radicals working to overturn the present power structure in this country. And they're doing it. Just want you guys to know, I don't believe in the left-right paradigm. It's bullshit. I'm not a Democrat because I'm talking about, I'm not a Democrat because I'm bashing the right wing and the Republican Party. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a progressive. I'm not anything except me. I'm a renegade. Get with the program. Council for National Policy is a think tank that goes out of its way to avoid publicity. When a top U.S. senator receives a major award from a national advocacy organization, it's standard procedure for both the politician and the group to eagerly tell as many people about it as possible. Press releases spew from fax machines and email clog reporters in boxes. The news media are summoned in the hope that favorable stories will appear in the newspapers, on radio, and on television. It was odd, therefore, that when U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, Republican of Tennessee, accepted a Thomas Jefferson Award from a national group at the Plaza Hotel in New York City in August. This would have been in 2005, I imagine. The media weren't notified. In fact, they weren't welcome to attend. The media, quotations, should not know when or where we meet or who takes part in our programs before or after a meeting. Unquote. Reads one of the cardinal rules of the organization that honored Frist. The membership list of this group is strictly confidential. Guests can attend only with the unanimous approval of the organization's executive committee. The group's leadership is so secretive that members are told not to refer to it by name in email messages. Anyone who breaks the rules can be tossed out. What is this group, and why is it so determined to avoid the public spotlight? Spotlight magazine. Funny. That answer is the Council for National Policy, otherwise known as the CNP. And if the name isn't familiar to you, don't be surprised. That's just what the council wants. The CNP was founded in 1981 as an umbrella organization of right-wing leaders who would gather regularly to plot strategy, share ideas, and fund causes and candidates to advance the far-right agenda. 23 years later, it is still secretly pursuing those goals with amazing success. Since its founding, the tax-exempt organization has been meeting three times a year. Members have come and gone, but all share something in common. They are powerful figures, drawn from both the religious right and the anti-government, anti-tax wing of the ultra-conservative movement. It may sound like a far-left conspiracy, but the CNP is all too real. Its critics would argue, all too influential. Maybe Hillary was correct when she said a far-reaching right-wing conspiracy.
because there's truth to that. What amazes most CNP opponents is the group's ability to avoid widespread public scrutiny. Despite nearly a quarter century of existence and involvement by wealthy and influential political figures, the CNP remains unknown to most Americans. Operating out of a nondescript office building in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Fairfax, Virginia, they had actually moved, the organization has managed to keep an extremely low profile, an amazing feat when one considers the people the CNP courts. Sounds a little tinfoil hat-ish to you, right? Trust me, it's getting worse. Founded in 1981, its first president was Tim LaHaye, famed millennialist, preacher, and writer of the Left Behind series of popular books about the end times and the second coming of Christ. He was also a co-founder of the Moral Majority. In the 1980s, he headed the American Coalition for Traditional Values. While heading that group, LaHaye said, if every Bible-believing, Christ-loving church would trust God to raise up an average of just one person over the next 10 years who would get elected, we would have more Christian candidates than there are offices. A list of former and past members reads like a who's who of conservative Christian right activists, anti-tax and anti-government activists, billionaire right-wing philanthropists, and GOP office holders, past and present. Right-wing religious leaders, Dr. Tim LaHaye, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, Focus on the Family, Howard Amundsen, Christian Reconstructionist, Reverend Donald Wildman, American Family Association, David W. Breeze, Christian Identity, William R. Bright, International Christian Leadership University, Robert P. Dugan, Jr., National Association of Evangelicals, Robert Grant, Christian Voice, Haldeman Hal W. Guffey, International Ministries Fellowship, Sarah DeVito Hardman, Christian Coalition of California, Seamus Hassan, Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, Donald Paul Hodo, Christian Coalition, James B. Jacobson, Christian Solidarity International, Bob Jones III, Bob Jones University, Ed McAteer, Religious Roundtable, Inc., Dow Shealy, Well, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, John A. Stormer, I Chronicles 1232 Ministries and author of None Dare Call It Treason, famous McCarthyite anti-communist creed, J. Strack, Christian motivational speaker, former appointee to Say No Drug Task Force, right-wing media and communications, L. Brent Basel III, Media Research Center, Stuart W. Epperson, Salem Communications Corporation, Tracy Freeney, AmeriVision Communications, Inc., Reed Irving, Accuracy and Media, Mark Maddox, USA Radio Network, Pat Matriskiani, Jeremiah Films, James D. McCotter, Media Management Group, Inc., Liz McCotter, Channel 26 Orlando, Patrick B. McGugan, The Daily Oklahoman, Sam Moore, Thomas Nelson Publishers, Thomas L. Phillips, Phillips Publishing International, Larry W. Pullen, Master Media International, Inc., Gary Snyder, member of Editorial Board, Valley Views, a conservative weekly newspaper, Bill Tierney, Capital Communications, Inc., George Uribe II, Uribe Communications and former political director of Alan Keyes for president. Alan Keyes is also CMP. Businessmen, lobbyists, lawyers, and political consultants. Gary Jarman, Jarman Consultants. David Keene, American Conservative Union. Larry Klayman, Judicial Watch. Mark R. Levine, we know Levine, right? Landmark Legal Foundation. Christopher Long, Freiss Associate. Edward A. Lazick, Nerds, Inc. Edith D. Nicola, National Rights to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Carolyn Melanick, Triad Management Services. Thomas E. McCabe, Killen, McCabe & Associates. Dana Meese, Deloitte & Touche Consulting Group. Eugene Meyer, Federalist Society. Ralph Reed, Century Strategies. William Bradford Reynolds, J.A. Seculo, American Center for Law and Justice. Kyle Stallings, Permian Basin Acquisition Fund. Alan Stevens, Capital Insurance Services of Mississippi. Christine Vollmer, Argos Services, K Street Lobbyist. Jack Webb, Jack Webb Associates. Summers White, Summers White Company. Funders of conservative causes, Nelson Bunker Hunt of the famed Texas-based family of oil tycoons. Various members of the Coors family, beer barons. Richard DeVos, Amway founder. Pierre S. DuPont the fourth. GOP Politicos, former Senator Jesse Helms. Dick Armey, who was former Freedom Works president, who's off doing his own thing now. We'll get into him another time. And Tom DeLay. GOP congressional leaders, Gary Bauer, Ed Meese, William G. Batchelder III, congressman, Dan Burton, congressman, John Doolittle, congressman, Robert K. Dornan, Senator D.M. Louch Faircloth, Ernest J. Istook, congressman, Senator John Kill, Senator Trent Lott, Senator Don Nichols, Tom Patterson, Arizona senator, Tony Perkins, L.A. state rep, H.L. Richardson, California Senator, David C. Schultheus, Colorado State Rep, Governor John H. Sununu, Governor Tommy G. Thompson, Conservative Apparatchiks, Paul Ryrick, Free Congress Foundation, Howard Phillips, Conservative Caucus, Larry Pratt, Arndt Gun Owners, Gun Owners of America, Oliver North, Richard Vigray, Morton C. Blackwell, Henry Cooper, High Frontier, Edwin J. Fulner, Jr., Heritage Foundation, Peter Flaherty, National Legal and Policy Center, Stephen Goodrich, National Right to Work Committee, Lone Maboon, U.S. Citizens Alliance, Raymond Moore, Moore Foundation, Henry M. Morris, Institute for Creation Science, Grover Norquist. We know Grover Norquist, I would imagine, by now. Philip Olson, Family Research Council, Phyllis Schlafly, John K. Sieglob, Lanille Wright Spivey Ingleforum, Lieutenant General Gordon Sumner, Jr., connected to various organizations associated with Reverend Sumner Moon. And what was the ultimate goals of this organization? Well, they stated them pretty clearly early on. In the summer of 1981, Woody Jenkins, a former Louisiana state lawmaker who served as the group's first executive director, told Newsweek bluntly, "One day before the end of this century, the council will be so influential that no president, regardless of power, party, or philosophy, will be able to ignore us or our concerns, or shut us out of the highest levels of government." Speaks for itself. From the beginning, the CNP sought to merge two strains of far-right thoughts, the theocratic religious right with the low-tax anti-government wing of the GOP. The theory was that the religious right would provide the grassroots activism and the muscle. The other faction would put up the money. The CNP has always reflected this two-barreled approach. The group's first president was LaHaye, then president of Family Life Seminars in Alcoon, California. LaHaye, a fundamentalist Baptist preacher who went on in the 1990s to launch the popular Left Behind series of apocalyptic potboilers, was an early anti-gay crusader and frequent basher of public education as he is today. Bringing together the two strains of the far right gave the CNP enormous leverage. The group, for example, could pick a candidate for public office and ply him or her with an individual donation and PAC money from its well-endowed business wing. The goals of the CNP then are similarly two-pronged. Activists like Norquist, who once said he wanted to shrink the federal government to a size where he could be drowned in a bathtub, are drawn to the group for its exaltation of unfettered capitalism, hostility toward social service spending, and low or no tax ideology. Dramatically scaling back the size of federal government and abolishing the last remnants of the New Deal may be one goal of the CMP, but many of the foot soldiers of the religious right sign on for a different crusade, desire to remake America in a Christian fundamentalist image, to make America great again. Since 1981, CNP members have worked assiduously to pack government bodies with ultra-conservative lawmakers who agree with the nation needs a major shift to the right economically and socially. They rail against popular culture and progressive lawmakers, calling them the culprits of the nation's moral decay. Laws must be passed and enforced, the group argues, that will bring organized prayer back to the public schools, outlaw abortion, prevent gays from achieving full civil rights, and fund private religious schools with tax funds. And what kind of conservatives are these? Run-of-the-mill regular folks or something else? Alongside figures like LaHaye and the leaders of the anti-abortion movement, the nascent CNP also included Joseph Kors, the wealthy beer magnate, Herbert and Nelson Bunker Hunt, two billionaire investors and energy company executives known for their advocacy of right-wing causes, and William Size, another wealthy businessman. Interestingly, the Hunts, the Size, and LaHaye all were affiliated with the John Birch Society, the conspiracy-based, obsessed, anti-communist group founded in 1959. LaHaye had lectured and conducted training seminars frequently for the society during the 1960s and 1970s, a time when the group was known for its campaign against the civil rights movement. In 1988, writer Russ Ballant noted in his book, The Kors Connection, that many CNP members have been associated with the outer reaches of the conservative movement. Tom Ellis, a top political operative of the ultra-conservative Jesse Helms, followed LaHaye as the CNP president in 1982. Ellis had a checkered past, having served as a director of a foundation called the Pioneer Fund, which has a long history of subsidizing efforts to prove blacks are genetically inferior to whites. In addition to obsessing over communist threats and buttressing white supremacist ideology, the CNP has included many members bent on replacing American democracy with a theocracy. Theocracy, guys. Think about that. Dominionism, theocracy. That's what they want. LaHaye, like the whole of the nation, religious right leaders, nurtures a strong contempt for the First Amendment principle of church and state separation. Okay. Contradictory there, don't you think? Because it seriously complicates their goals of installing fundamentalist Christianity as the nation's officially recognized religion, LaHaye has worked within the CNP and other groups to replace American law with biblical law. And George Herbert Walker Bush happened to pass the No-Hide laws while he was in office. So, check mark for CNP for getting something done for them. For many years, the late leader of the Christian Reconstruction Movement, Rosas J. Rushdoony, was a member. Reconstructionists espouse a radical theology that calls for the trashing the U.S. Constitution and replacing it with the harsh legal code of the Old Testament. They advocate the death penalty for adulterers, blasphemers, incorrigible teenagers, gay people, witches, and those who worship false gods. That would mean that Renegade would be lynched or burned at the stake, wouldn't it? Another CNP Reconstructionist tie comes through Howard Phillips, the Constitution Party leader. Phillips, a longtime CNP member, is a disciple of Rushdoony and uses rhetoric that strikes a distinctly Reconstructionist tone. In a 2003 Constitution Party gathering in Clackamas, Oregon, Phillips told party members and guests, "We've got to be ready when God chooses to let us restore our once great republic." A report by the Southern Poverty Law Center said that Phillips proclaimed that his party was raising up an army to take back this nation. The CNP's current executive director, a former California lawmaker named Steve Baldwin, I think he's related to Chucky Baldwin, also CNP, has tried to downplay the organization's influence on powerful state and national lawmakers. He has remained cagey about the CNP's goals, insisting it is merely a group that counters liberal policy arguments. In many ways, Baldwin himself exemplifies the CNP's operate-in-secret strategy. As a political strategist in California in the early 1990s, Baldwin was one of the key architects of the stealth strategy that led to religious right activists being elected to school boards and other local offices. I understand that California is now teaching a lot of Scientology in their schools. Stealth candidates were trained to emphasize pocketbook issues such as taxes and spending. But once elected, they would pursue a religious right agenda, such as demanding creationism in public schools. In the spring of 2002, while working at the CNP, he penned a controversial article for the Law reviewed at TV preacher Pat Robertson, Regent University. The piece, "Child Molestation and the Homosexual Movement," linked pedophilia to homosexuality. Nothing wrong with that. The article went on to become a staple in the religious right anti-gay canon, despite the fact that its claims were challenged by legitimate researchers. "It is difficult to convey the dark side of homosexual culture without appearing harsh," wrote Baldwin. "However, it is time to acknowledge that homosexual behavior threatens the foundation of Western civilization, the nuclear family." I agree with that. "And who do these folks honor with their most prestigious awards, even though they don't publicize them? Why, the most conservative leaders, judges, and politicians, of course. Here are some of their honorees: Thomas Jefferson Award for Servant Leadership, 2004, Bill Frist; 1997, Ward Connolly; 1996, Paul Weyrich; 1995, Edwin J. Fulner, Jr.; 1994, Phyllis Schlafly; 1993, Daniel O'Graham; 1992, Clarence Thomas, yeah, Supreme Court Justice; 1991, Robert H. Crable; 1990, James Dobson; 1989, Ellen St. John Garwood; 1988, William Armstrong; 1987, Fred Schwartz; 1986, Edwin Meese III; 1985, William J. Bennett; 1984, John F. Lehman; 1983, Jesse Helms; 1982, Jean J. Kirkpatrick. The New York Times, in a 2004 article, reported that Bush attended a 1999 CNP function, and Rumsfeld and Cheney have both been speakers since the Iraq War was initiated. So clearly the Bush administration takes these folks very seriously. Actually, Bush was vetted by the CNP. Other speakers at the August 2004 event included Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rudy Giuliani, two supposedly moderate Republicans. "Fellow Cossacks, these are the people who should go on our enemies list. I urge you to read the full article at the American United for Separation Church and State website." Here, boom, boom. And that would be that article. Here are guests that have been on the Alex Jones Show. I've already mentioned Rand Paul. Stan Monteith, CNP member, JBS member, head of Santa Cruz chapter, member of Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. Pat Robertson wrote the book exposing NWO in 1991, calling it a worldwide Jewish conspiracy, yet he is an ardent Zionist and supporter of Israel. And Monteith called Dr. Peter Duisberg, who opposed AIDS and HIV hoax. Dr. Peter Duisberg is a CIA operative. G. Edward Griffin, libertarian, helped George Wallace's campaign in 1968. I don't see that being a problem. But JBS member and writes for their magazine New American. Endorsed Ron Paul in 2008. Wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, which plagiarized earlier work from Eustace Mullins and injected the pro gold standard position. Ironically, Eustace Mullins' book made it clear that gold standard was a banker operation. I agree with that. And Ron Paul did write a book with Louis Lehrman, Jew, called The Case for Gold. And Louis Lehrman, Project for American New American Century, owner, director at one point of Rite Aid Drugstore, funder of Arbusta Oil, George Bush's company, CFR CNP member, Skull and Bones member over at Yale. So, yeah, Ron Paul's got some good friends too. And this G. Edward Griffin also has a think tank by the call the name of Freedom Force International. Freedom Force International. Alex Jones is a member. And where'd that go? Freedom Force International, Alex Jones, Jack Blood is a member. And if you want to be a lifetime member, it's $13,000 one-time fee for G. Edward Griffin's think tank. There's a lot of other shady characters that are members of that group as well. If you want to go look, Google them at Freedom Force International. Cleon Skousen, Mormon, Freemason, JBS member and was on the cover of New American Magazine. Worked with FBI for a short period. CNP member, wrote book 5,000 Year Leap, which was promoted by Glenn Beck and Rick Perry. And Glenn Beck wrote a foreword in the new edition. Joel Skousen, son of Cleon Skousen. Mormon, Ron Paul supporter, CNP member. Gary Allen, JBS member, speechwriter for George Wallace as well. Advisor for Knights of Malta oil billionaire and founder of CNP Nelson Bunker Hunt. Wrote, None Dare Call It a Conspiracy, which Alex Jones claims him, which focus on the New World Order conspiracy. This book was prefaced by Congressman John G. Schmitz, who is also a John Birch Society member, Blackwater mercenary employee, and a Knight of Malta. Phyllis Schlafly, we talked about. I don't want to beat her up to death. She is a Dame of Malta also that I didn't mention. And she is part of the Merovingian bloodline on both sides of her family. She worked for the American Enterprise Institute. Members include U.S. Ambassador UN John Bolton, also part of the PNAC group. Lion Cheney, neocon Newt Gingrich, CNP. Former World Bank head and Zionist neocon Paul Wolfowitz, CNP, Project for a New American Century. Paul Craig Roberts made his rounds to the Patriot movement quite a bit. He also writes for a website, globalresearch.com. We'll be back for one more half hour.
70 years of propaganda created a public perception of Adolf Hitler as mythical as anything to be found in a Disneyland theme park. Now, thanks to the internet and Amazon self-publishing, we can finally access taboo information. This offers you opportunity to benefit from the respect of others. There is much satisfaction to be had by putting someone right and proving it. Mike Walsh, Third Reich Spin-Free Truth Books, opens up a world of previously blocked information. Especially recommended is Mike Walsh's Witness to History. Go to Amazon Books or Kindle. Check Mike Walsh Witness to History.
Welcome back, everybody, for the last half an hour, and I want to let you guys know that there will be a bonus hour. Sean will be doing an hour after I am done in the next half an hour. You guys are getting a real treat tonight. Happy Friday going into Saturday. All right, Paul Craig Roberts. Pruneface is his nickname, by the way. He's an economist who worked for the Reagan administration, father of Reaganomics, which is part of the whole libertarianism movement that we're seeing now. The trickle down, and member of the Cato Institute, funded by the Koch brothers, the CIA op, and Murray Rothbard, Austrian school economics that you see you're outright praising the Rothbarders. He's also a member of the CMP, member of the Hoover Institute, such members like Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. John McManus, another guest of the Alex Jones Show, current head of the John Birch Society and a Jesuit trained operative. Michael Savage, another guest of the Alex Jones Show, proud Zionist, endorsed Rick Perry, promoter of communist fear mongering and Islamophobia, believes Obama is a foreign communist agent who will take over our government. Well, kind of happened, but. Pastor David Manning, another guest, proud Zionist, ultra-nationalist Jew who founded Jewish Defense League. Okay. George Norrie, another show. Joseph Farah, founded alternative media WorldNet Daily, which regularly pushes Zionist and neocon propaganda. And he's linked to the WorldNet Daily, is a member of the U.S. Committee for Free Lebanon, which is supported by PNAC and advocates regime change in Syria and Lebanon. This group is also anti-Hezbollah, is associated with many Zionists like Daniel Pipes, Michael Rubin, and, of course, one himself. Lord Christopher Monckton, Knights of Malta. Parents were also Knights of Malta. Advisor for Margaret Thatcher, Conservative Party. Advisor to UKIP. Didn't know that. Nigel Farage. Didn't know he was a guest on the Alex Jones Show. UKIP leader. British version of Ron Paul, pushing same economic agenda of mass austerity and cuts in corporate taxes. Israel supporter. Larry Pratt, co-chair for Knights of Malta. Pat Buchanan, and presidential campaign, linked to white supremacist groups and Christian identity groups, white people who think they are the true Israelites of the Bible. Board member of American Legislative Executive Council, which is ALEC, funded by the Koch industry money. They pass a lot of legislature.
Of course, a rabid gun activist. Well, he does control Gun Owners of America, right? Member of the CNP, helped found Council for Inter-American Security, which was a right-wing foreign policy group connected to the John Birch Society, World Anti-Communist League, which I talked about earlier, and was involved in Iran-Contra and running dust squads in Central America and Asia. Pat Buchanan. All these outriders have a love affair with him, especially Vidar. Knight of Malta also helped found Council for Inter-American Security, which ran dust squads in Central America. Alex Jones helped his presidential campaign, worked as advisor to Ford, Nixon, and Reagan. Jerome Corsi, member of CMP, writes for Joseph Farah's WorldNet Daily. Steve Pichenik worked as Deputy Secretary of State under Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush, CFR member. That's just some of those guests. And then we've had Roger Stone on there quite a bit lately, haven't we? We had Louis Farrakhan on there not too long ago. We had Donald Trump also on the show not too long ago. Here we go. Some more members of Council for National Policy. Jack Abramoff, Casino Jack. International Freedom Foundation, IFF, organization founded by conservative activists. Jack Abramoff was recently exposed by senior South African military personnel as a cutout of the South African military and special branch. IFF functioned as a propaganda arm for South African Stratcom counterinsurgency operations directed against the African National Congress and the Trade Union Confederation. Well, that's fine if they're going against the ANC, in my opinion. Jack Abramoff became a Washington lobbyist after the Republicans won the House in 1994, and he has ties that reach to all aspects of Washington. Recently got out of prison. He played a key role in what was called the K Street Project. I'm going to be dissecting K Street and its think tanks later on in these additional shows. Lobbyist Jack Abramoff admitted to defrauding at least four Native American tribes of tens of millions of dollars, bribing government officials and evading taxes. Abramoff has reportedly agreed to testify against several members of Congress who receive favors or donations from him or his big clients. Howard A. Menson, Jr., CMP Board of Directors. Council for National Policy, major financial supporter and board member of Chao Chien-Den, president of Fieldsted and Company, Fieldsted Foundation, board of directors of Claremont Institute. Amundsen is an Orange County financier who inherited his home savings of America from his father, has spent millions promoting far-right candidates, first in California and then nationwide. And he served more than 20 years on the board of the Cal Sidon Institute in Vallecito, California, a think tank devoted to the teachings of its leaders, the Reverend Rosas John Rushdoony. Okay. The Fieldsted Institute helped to fund the book Restorers of Hope, written by Amy L. Sherman, which is a PR piece for Welfare Reform's Charitable Choice. When he was asked in a phone interview who they were, and she said Family Research Council, the Heritage Foundation, and the Center for Public Justice. The public book doesn't mention it, but Sherman works part-time at the Rockefeller-funded Manhattan Institute for Public Policy, which has crossover people with both Brookings Institute and Hudson Institute, Diane Ravitch and Chester Finn. The Manhattan Institute Center for Civic Innovation, CCI, is involved in education reform, welfare reform, as well as the Jeremiah Project. Thomas R. Anderson, CNP Board of Directors, Family Research Council. Dr. John F. Ankleberg, Ankleberg Theological Research. Honorary Dick Richard K. Army, we talked about him. And he was part of the CNP, of course, Moral Majority Leader, United States House of Reps, main author, Contract with America, which is unveiled during a Capitol signing ceremony in 1994, featuring over 300 Republican members and candidates, former chairman, Department of Economics, North Texas University, Price Theory, listed in the Who's Who in America. Thomas K. Strong, Armstrong Foundation. Senator William Armstrong, Senator, Chairman of the Subcommittee on Economic Policy, Senator, Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. 1981, he was the author of the tax indexing provisions of the Reagan administration's tax cuts. Senator Armstrong is also a board member of the Free Congress Research and Educational Foundation, headed by Paul Weyrich, and part by Adolf Kors Foundation, the Smith Richardson Foundation, and Richard Mellon Scaife Foundation, Advisory Board of Intercessions for America. John M. Ashbrook, Congressman, Chairman of the American Conservative Union, Member of Committee of Conservative Alternatives, Conservative Political Action Conference, and Young Americans for Freedom in Cooperation with Human Events, and the National Review. So you do have National Review people connected with this as well. Edward G. Atzinger III, Salem Communications Corporation, Religious Broadcasters Music License Committee. A lot of connections with him. Theodore Baer, Christian Film and Television Commission. I want to find some good names here. People that are recognizable. Honorable Gary Bauer, Family Research Counselor. Merged with Focus on the Family, then reorganized as a separate 501c3 and 501c3 and incorporated such as the District of Columbia. Bauer was featured as a speaker at the Moon's Women's Federation for World Peace Conference in Washington, D.C. and had a full-page ad in the Moon-owned Washington Times. New headquarters for FRC, a six-story building, stands at G Street instead of K Street. In the heart of the nation's capital, was built and decorated with funds through resources provided by FRC benefactors, that's Family Research Council. The families of Ed and Elsa Prince, which is Eric Prince's parents, who own Blackwater, which is now Academy, changed names a couple times to Academy. And 33rd degree Mason Richard DeVos of Amway fame, and Elsa Prince's, Eric Prince's sister did marry one of the DeVos sons. So there's a merger there with the Blackwater and Amway through marriage. John Beckett, Intercessions for America, Religious Roundtable. Morton Blackwell, we talked about, big guy for CNP. Pat Boone, Director, Board of Directors, Clement Stone, Religious Heritage of America. He's an elder in Jack Hafford's Foursquare Gospel Church and Way in Van Guy in News, California, where Trinity Broadcasting Network founders Paul and Jan Crouch are members. So you have Trinity Broadcasting Network connected with the CNP. Should have grabbed these people and put them all into a spreadsheet. Tons of the Kors family, brewing company. Terry Dolan. That was the guy who died of AIDS. Former member of the advisory board of CAUSA. Top eight of Sungyeon Moon, Terry Dolan, Paul Ryrick, Richard Vigoray, and Howard Phillips were the main architects and commanding generals of the New Right. Dolan, co-founder and national chairman of the 300,000-member National Conservative Political Action, organized the Conservative Alliance called CALL. Yeah, that's too bad. 15 more minutes. Yeah, I need to go on something else. Sorry about that, guys. I want to talk about Sungyeon Moon, since a lot of people probably don't even know who he was. The crowning at the Capitol creates a stir. I mentioned that earlier. This happened June 2004. As a shining symbol of democracy, the United States Capitol is not ordinarily a place where coronations occur. So news that the Reverend Sungyeon Moon, the eccentric and exceedingly wealthy Korean-born businessman, donned a crown in a Senate office building and declared himself the Messiah while members of Congress watched is a causing bit of a stir. One congressman, Representative Danny K. Davis, Democrat of Illinois, wore white gloves and carried a pillow holding one of two ornate gold crowns that were placed on the heads of Mr. Moon and his wife. Dr. Hak Ja-hae Moon, at the ceremony which took place March 23rd and capped the reception billed as a peace rewards banquet. All right. Oh, man. That wasn't very good. Horrible article. Ay, ay, ay. Not very organized here. I'm sorry, everybody. I really don't think that I'm ready to go on anymore. Hey, Sean, if you want to just play some music, man, I really don't have anything. So, sorry, guys. I'm burnt out.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, well, that sort of thing does happen once in a while where you get to the end of your, you sort of get to the end of your show and then you think, well, hold on a second, I've just got to talk it out, but unfortunately, once in a while, you get to that point where you just think to yourself, no, you know, I'm done, and that's all I can do at the moment, and obviously that's the brick wall that Mr. Sparrow has hit just then. And, you know, at one stage or another, we all go through it as hosts. You get better and better at hosting as you go, but occasionally it does sort of knock you about, you know, especially if you're just getting back into broadcasting. Nick was doing shows often enough way back when, and then he got out of it for a while, had a bit of a break. And when you come back, sometimes it needs a little exercise before you can actually, you know, make the full two or make the full three. I know some people that can't even talk for 5 minutes, so what we're doing here at Renegade Broadcasting is quite amazing, really. But a tilt of the hat to Nick for making it so long. He's had a lot of information to cover. And he's done well at doing it, in my opinion. In fact, there's something that a lot of people don't understand about Nick Sparrow, is that much of the information that he had, or rather Josh Reeves had, when Josh Reeves was on Oracle, when it comes to the CNP, the Council for National Policy, came from Nick himself. Nick was doing a lot of behind-the-scenes research and passing it over to Josh Reeves, and Josh Reeves was bringing it to the table without even giving credit to Nick, or at least I never heard credit given where it was due, that's for sure. So, again, a tilt of the hat to Nick for almost getting through the 3 hours with a hell of a lot of great research there. There's no doubt about it. What we're going to do at the moment is play a little music for you. If you have any requests in the chat room, by all means, let us know, and I will play that music until we get to the end of the hour, at which point you will get a bonus Twos Company Threes Allowed, because I will be doing 1 hour, just a 1 hour bonus edition of Twos Company Threes Allowed, where I will be covering some of the Renegade Tribune, some Renegade Tribune articles. And if you haven't heard of the Renegade Tribune before, by all means, get on over to renegadetribune.com, all one word, when it comes to Renegade Tribune. Renegade Tribune, all one word, .com, and you'll be able to take a look at some of the quote-unquote diversity, if you will, diversity when it comes to the different authors and the different articles. And I'm sure that there's something that will be able to tickle your fancy over there, because there's always something for everybody. So what we're going to do is just play a little music, background music at the moment, until we come to the next part, the next hour, I mean, where I will then do the bonus 1 hour TCTA, because I didn't exactly get enough time to cover everything that I wanted to cover yesterday. And I'm going to do that tonight. So if any of you have a request in the chat room for a couple of songs, get them in now, because that way we can fill the rest of this hour. In the meantime, you're listening to the soundtrack that comes from a game called X Rebirth. If you haven't got yourself a copy of that and you're an avid space theme type player, then grab yourself a copy of X Rebirth on Steam or whatever venue you use. It can be an interesting game now that they've ironed out a hell of a lot of the bugs. Okay, we've had a quick request in the chat room there. Mr. Floppy will sing Homebrew. I've never heard this before, so I'm hoping it's not too bloody vulgar. It's looking a bit questionable to me. And you just don't know with these chatters in the chat room. This is a request for Jew Banker in the chat room. Mr. Floppy, Homebrew, do I really want to know? All right, let's see what this is about. Goodness gracious.
Mr. Floppy. Mr. Fluffius.
Goodness gracious. Jew Banker, what are you on?
Really serious bit. Really serious bit. You can drink it in the kitchen. You can drink it in your bed. This lovely lager.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen, Homebrew by Mr. Floppy. Yes, there's some sick people in this world, there's no doubt about it. Homebrew by Mr. Floppy. You know, once upon a time I thought I had time on my hands. I mean, these days I don't, but, you know, back in my teenage years and in my 20s and everything, I thought I had a lot of time on my hands. No, I had nothing compared to Mr. Floppy. There's no doubt about it. Let me kill Mr. Floppy. let me get Mr. Floppy out of the way. Jesus. So, yes, you've been listening to Circus Maximus with Nick Sparrow. I'm just filling in for the last part of the hour, after which we're going to be moving to a bonus one-hour edition of TCTA. As I was saying earlier before, Mr. Floppy rudely invaded the broadcast there. What happens is I didn't get to say what I wanted to say entirely when it comes to yesterday's show. So there's a few things I want to read out over there at the Renegade Tribune, maybe even a couple of things to discuss when it comes to infostormer.com. So by all means, stay tuned for that. If you're a little sleepy, I do know that a lot of you over in the UK, it's getting into the daylight hours just now. And over in America, of course, we're now 1 a.m. over here in Australia. What time is it here in Australia? It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so there you go. I literally have to live by the American time standard, ladies and gentlemen, to keep my bearings about me when it comes to the network. It's very confusing. Sometimes I set my alarm for 2100 instead of 9 a.m. it's very confusing, especially after daylight savings changes over in the United States and then daylight savings changes over here. Then there's 2 hours the difference. Very hard to get used to. Okay, we're heading into the bonus edition of TCTA. By all means, thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. RenegadeBroadcasting.com.